Welcome to Women Mean Business, the new podcast from the Conference for Women. I'm your host, Lisa Bennett, and today I'm delighted to say we'll be hearing from the one and only Sean Aker, one of the world's leading experts on happiness and success, who also joyfully embodies what he teaches. One of the most popular TED speakers of all time, Sean has also been a beloved four-time keynoter at the conferences for women. With his best-selling book, The Happiness Advantage, Sean turned our understanding of happiness and success upside down, showing that it is not success that leads to happiness, but happiness that leads to success. In his most recent book, Big Potential, he similarly challenges conventional thinking about potential, showing that every dimension of human potential, performance, intelligence, creativity, leadership ability, and health, are influenced by the company we keep. We caught up with Sean before his most recent talk at the Massachusetts Conference for Women. So Sean, you were involved in teaching the most popular class at Harvard on happiness. And then you left academia to bring your knowledge to the workplace and to conferences like the Massachusetts Conference for Women that we're at now and you'll soon be speaking at. So how's that going? Are workplaces and women getting happier?
It's been a fantastic journey, I have to say. I got started when Dr. Tal Ben-Shahar, who is the lecturer for positive psychology, decided to move the class he was teaching, which was a seminar class, to bring it to more students at Harvard. And I had gotten to know, you know, a lot of the students in my work there. I spent about 12 years there by the end. So we partnered together on it. I was a head teaching fellow for his course, and the course took off. By the end of our time together, we had taught one out of every five Harvard students about happiness, and there was a real hunger that was there. But there was also a hunger to be able to quantify these types of changes in people's lives, to see if you could apply science to something that seems so soft. Of course, we could apply science to something like depression or anxiety, but to bring science to something like happiness or compassion or altruism or hope, those seem too soft at first. And once we realize that it's the same spectrum, it's the same metrics oftentimes that we can use to test for optimism and pessimism or depression and happiness or joy, we got hooked. But the more I started sharing this outside of academia, the more I started to realize that while we needed so much more science, and I've continued that even to this day, we're doing lots of work researching this out at companies and schools, I realized that we've learned so much that the rest of the world didn't know about yet. They were still following cultural myths, such as that your happiness is just your genes and your environment, and that's all we are, so we're victims of both. So the ability to bring this out into the world was important to me, but then I realized that there was a real need for it. Mm-hmm. I got started during the banking crisis, so I started working with companies in the midst of an economic downturn that we didn't know when it would end. And now I'm working with companies and schools. I've worked with nearly half of the Fortune 100 companies. We're working with schools across the nation. And what we're able to do now is to battle test this research. It's very easy to test something when you can control all the variables in the lab, although that's hard in and of itself. But out in the messiness of life, when you're waking up with a two-year-old at 3 or 4 in the morning while going into work, while trying to balance your finances and a personal life and trying to create happiness and caring for aging parents, it's a very different story than testing just college students in a psych laboratory in terms of happiness. So it's been an incredible laboratory bringing this research out into the world, and then not only bringing it out, but then testing to see what works in schools in Flint, Michigan, what works with banks that are failing, what works with women that are trying to create careers in the midst of a world in which there's not pay equity. So how do we find happiness in the midst of the messiness of life is what I've devoted my life to.
Wow. Well, that's very real, and you know something about trying to do this with a two-year-old.
Yes.
So one of the things that you've done is really turned our conventional thinking about happiness and success on its head, right? So can you tell us about that?
Sure. So initially when I got into Harvard, I assumed that getting into a good school would make me happy for the rest of my life. And very quickly, as you look around the students, you get disillusioned of that very, very fast, because you wonder what's going to happen to you 4 years from now. And now you're in the midst of competition. And now you're judging yourself based upon your peers, your grades, your Facebook. And suddenly what should have created great levels of happiness wasn't. Now that I work out in companies across the globe, I work with people that have power and have income and that have position, and they're not happy at all. That the success didn't correlate with the levels of happiness we assume they will while we pursue success. So as we look back through the research, what we started to see continually was success didn't lead to greater levels of happiness. If your success rates, depending on how you define it, rise for the next 5 year period of time, happiness levels for you flatline. They don't actually move. What I found fascinating though is that there was still a correlation, actually not just a correlation, a causation that was occurring there, that while success didn't lead to happiness, greater levels of happiness, optimism, social connection, joy, those dramatically improved every business and educational outcome we knew how to test for. So suddenly, you see a connection between happiness and success, but it was going in the opposite direction that we planned. So that's one of the very first things I do, that I work with not just highly successful people, but you know, students trying to graduate from college or get into college despite, you know, the cost of college, or you know, working with people that are homeless or that are coming back from combat services, and finding a way of being able to help them to realize that happiness won't exist at some point in the future once they have some sort of success, a certain nest egg, a certain level of security, a certain level of being married or having kids. But the opposite occurs, that when we can focus on being happy, optimistic in the present, our success rates at finding jobs, at you know, being able to save money, at being able to live healthy lifestyles, those rise dramatically.
So one of the things that's so interesting about your work is that, you know, psychology for a very long time has focused on people's troubles, right? And how do we deal with depression and anxiety and all kinds of other issues? And, you know, you're on the best of the positive side in focusing on happiness. How did you personally make the decision to do that?
So I think both are important, both the positive and the negative research. They both can lead to positive outcomes. The more we know about the depression, the more we can be compassionate, the more we know how to treat it. But oftentimes, if you're studying only the negative, we're not learning about what allows us to rise above our current levels of depression, what allows us to overcome trauma that we experienced in childhood. What we have to look for those are people that have experienced those negative things and then somehow experienced post-traumatic growth, or somehow were able to transform their lives. And that's where I get fascinated, is the change point. I'm interested in where people are right now, but what I like to study is where they're going. And could they move in a different direction? I see this because I went through 2 years of depression, more than 2 years, I realized in retrospect, more than 2 years of depression while I was at Harvard. And I was in the midst of success. I was in an incredible place. I had lots of people around me, and I still went through depression. Probably born with genes for optimism, also probably born with genes for, we have family history of depression. So probably had genetics at set point that was leading towards the depression. And I went deeper and deeper into depression until I started applying some of these positive psychology things I've been learning from Dr. Talvin Shahar, Ellen Langer at Harvard, Dr. Phil Stone. These people kind of brought this into my life right when I needed it. And what I got to see was that the depression was not the end of the story, and that there were ways to walk ourselves out of something I thought would not end, which was the depression. And so now what I do is study what individuals can do to move from one negative state to a positive state, and then how do we sustain it?
Yeah, so it sounds like there's a real helping motivation there. Is there?
There is, because I feel the compassion. I understand now that depression's not something you just think yourself out of. And that you need other people for it too. I had people that inspired me to pursue positive psychology. It wasn't like I discovered it all by myself and then decided to do it. I had people that were in my life that were positive influences. So that's what I want to be in this world, is I want to be a positive influence to just help people on that journey back to positive, or to help them make more positive change. So I work a lot with teachers now in inner city schools, and how do you find ways of being able to buoy them enough so that they can inspire these students who are dealing with a lot more things than I dealt with when I was, you know, in a public school back in Texas.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you for doing that. I think, you know, the if we can just get personal for a second, you mentioned maybe having, you know, an optimistic gene. Your family is amazing, right? You know, you're a happiness researcher, your sister's a happiness researcher, your wife is a happiness researcher. What is it like when you're all together?
It's great because we speak a common language. Mm-hmm. We can call each other when we know we're not living the research. Mm-hmm. Like my wife, if I start complaining too much, she'll let me complain and vent, but then she won't let me ruminate there. Mm-hmm. She won't let me stop because she's like, she'll listen to when I'm upset that a flight has been delayed, mm-hmm. but she doesn't let me lose perspective that I just got to fly home from giving a talk on happiness and fly home to children and to her. Mm-hmm. So while I think it's, what it's been great for is to have somebody to hold you accountable, which mm-hmm. not everyone has. Mm-hmm. So I'm really grateful for that. And a common language so we can, you know, very quickly assess what's going on within each other's lives. But if you look at our family, we're all into positive psychology because I met Dr. Tal Ben-Shahar. Mm-hmm. He's into positive psychology because he met Ellen Langer, who was following all of these, you know, humanistic psychologists mm-hmm. within their field. And so there's a whole tree of positive influencers that have existed all throughout history that I hope we're continuing in the midst of so much focus on the negative and the stressful within this world.
Yeah, indeed. And here you are sharing it with all the women and men here. I guess you just answered the question I was just thinking about, which was how is it that you and your sister ended up, you know, is there a genetic connection to this kind of interest?
My sister and I are genetically pretty different. And firstborn, secondborn, we've got all the, you know, prototypical differences there. I think that was much more an environmental one, but also conscious choices. So I think that it's the height of our potential is predicted by the people that surround you. She married a very positive pediatrician from the military, who was one of my friends at Harvard, whose parents came from Ghana. So you see all these different types of interactions that come together, cross culture, cross genetic background, cross economics, still coming to some of those same conclusions, that change is possible, that happiness could be a choice if we applied effort at it, and that happiness could be an advantage in our schools and in our companies.
One of the things that people may not know so much about you is that you went to Harvard Divinity School.
That's right, yeah.
How does that figure in? Did that help lead to this kind of...
It did. It led directly to it. I studied Christian and Buddhist ethics uh-huh. while I was there. I grew up Christian, grew up in Waco, Texas, so that's all there was. So I picked the only option. and still I'm Christian to this day, but it was my first exposure to something different. And a whole world of differences. And so I got interested in what motivates people to wake up in the morning, what causes people to, want to, give or forgive. So all those questions I was asking were psychological questions that now we can measure in many ways. But I think the best compliment I've ever received in this work is that I'm a missionary for happiness research. Mm. It's the one that puts a smile on my face because that's who I want to be deep down, is that I feel like my spiritual calling is to use the language of science to open conversations about how positive change ripples throughout a society, about how love wins in the end, mm-hmm. about how that optimism in the end is so much stronger than our pessimistic tendencies, mm-hmm. and that gratitude can be based upon something. So that's what I'm hoping I'm doing in my work.
Wonderful. Let's switch gears a little bit and put this in a context for the country and,
yes.
talk about the other side of the experience.
Yeah.
The World Happiness Report, the most recent one, ranked America 18th. Having dropped four positions from 2017. And then the one that was most interesting to me, America ranked 85th on the happiness equality scale, indicating that some folks are a lot less happy
yes.
than others. Can you help us understand that?
I think that the global research is challenging. I focus a lot more on the individual side because mm-hmm. it's so much easier for me to get a handle on. When you look at the global things, you have to ask questions like, should I measure educational levels in terms of correlate with happiness? because I've been to a lot of places that have very low education that are extraordinarily optimistic, positive, and happy. And I've gone into places like Harvard with extraordinary wealth and success and educational prestige, and 80% of the students go through depression. So I don't discount the global research, but I think it's hard to read in terms of what it means for me, because you know, the U.S. might have dropped four places, but maybe that four countries are starting to figure out happiness. Right? You know, on the other side of it is, I do think that there's an there's absolutely income inequality in the United States, and a growing one, and one of our largest problems. I don't think that there's an automatic correlation between income and happiness levels. Above extreme poverty, we find that happiness only rises slightly with income. I think it's better to have income as a country and as an individual, because I don't think it buys you happiness, but it saves you from some insecurity that can occur if bad things happen, like insurance, for example. Mm-hmm. But I worry about comparing wealthy countries or wealthy individuals to ones that are not, and then determining happiness based upon that. So what we look for are those individual traits that people are experiencing in terms of happiness. Allow that them to decide that for themselves. So not to dodge your question completely, is I think we're going in the wrong direction in the U.S. And I think we're going the wrong direction because I worked with the CDC, went out and gave a talk there, and they said, well, I've been doing all this research and going around speaking for a decade. During that same decade, the depression screen is the exact same, and the depression rates have doubled for every age group. Hospitalizations for suicide for every age group have doubled, including eight-year-olds. So something's not going right. Mm-hmm. The trend is going in the wrong direction. Mm-hmm. And the wealth and the technological know-how have not correlated with the levels of happiness we want. And I believe one of the large reasons for that is we've lost social connection. Mm-hmm. We have social connectivity through the internet. But I think on the other side, we feel more and more independent, which means we're less interdependent, which means, you know, people are pursuing spirituality alone, mm-hmm. instead of in a community. Mm-hmm. They're bowling alone instead of in bowling leagues, as Robert Putnam talked mm-hmm. about. We're finding ourselves being able to scatter across the globe for jobs and leaving all of our ties and families behind. Whereas in the past, the majority of humans lived within, you know, a few mile radius of their village. So I think something is extraordinarily lost there, because the greatest predictor of happiness is social connection. So when I see those types of trends occurring, I think the United States and many other developed countries might have a lot to learn from developed countries about how to create happiness based upon social connection and family.
Right. There's so much to talk with you about, and I know you have a big talk to get ready for in a moment, but so let's pivot for a moment to some of the things that you might share with the audience here about happiness in the workplace. You've said that it's an advantage. Mm-hmm. Why is it an advantage?
In short, every business outcome we know how to test for improves when the human brain is positive first. Sales rise by 37%, productivity rises by 31%, a neutral sales force race to the top quartile of sales, their sales rise significantly over what they would have been at negative, neutral, or merely stressed. We find your likelihood of promotion rises by 40%. I did a study here with Conferences for Women that came out in the Harvard Business Review. One of the things we found is that comparing women that are similar in the sense that they're the type of women who would sign up for a women's conference. Comparing those groups over the same economic period of time, so people who are planning on attending but who had not attended yet one of the conferences for women, and women who had attended, we found that the likelihood of promotion over the next two-year period of time, their likelihood of promotion doubled after they had attended, and their likelihood of a more than 10% pay increase tripled. So as a researcher, I actually went back into the data because that was way too robust. I love seeing data that's exciting, but for us, like a 6% rise is great. We shouldn't be seeing things like double or triple. So we went back into it, and it's accurate, and it's stunning. Same sample groups, basically, same economic period of time, massive gain. So I think that there is a huge benefit to events and conferences like this, where you include more people that are not normally included in some of these, you know, conversations, that you have conversations with like-minded individuals. We tested in this case conferences for women, but you know, I think that it is so important as we look at diversity and inclusion in the workforce to be looking at similarly minded individuals having an opportunity not only to know that they're not alone, I think that's the biggest thing, but also to learn from one another. So we think on the backside of it, and we ask some of these questions, maybe they were offering, maybe they were learning strategies about how to ask for promotions or ask for raises, and they were learning that from individuals who've actually experienced it within their lives. But also, my favorite study right now is done by two researchers of Virginia, and I'll talk about this in my talk, where if you're looking at a hill you need to climb in front of you, if you're perceiving that hill alone, your brain shows you a picture of a mountain that is 10 to 20% steeper than a mountain of the same height you perceive while standing next to a friend who's going to climb it with you.
Amazing.
So I think sitting in a ballroom at a conference center next to hundreds, if not thousands, of like-minded individuals, in this case women, who are experiencing some of your frustration, who are experiencing some of the discrimination, who are experiencing some of the past experiences you have, bonding together to learn allows you to feel like those mountains you're trying to climb are less steep, and actually shows you a mountain. And that's a physical one. We're starting to believe the emotional ones is more than 10 to 20% change that's occurring. We're still working on that research right now. But what I think is a huge indication of is why this is so important. And we're hoping more and more companies start to realize this, because it's not just about well-being, which is incredibly important, but it's important to their bottom line. We worked with companies, we raised their, one large insurance company, we raised their revenues by 50% in an 18-month period of time by simply applying gratitude exercises and getting people to create these emotional huddles in call centers. We're working with a school that went from the 73rd academic percentile nationwide to the 96th percentile, a bottom 10% school who applied these principles, and 5 years later in Iowa, it's open enrollment. Kids from the richer counties are coming to the poorest school in Iowa to go to a bottom 10% school because their literacy rates have risen so dramatically. The students there are positive. Their test scores are, on the ACT have risen by 3.5 points. The teachers want to go there even though it's the poorest county in Iowa. So there's happiness is an extraordinary advantage. Every key performance indicator rises when the human brain's positive. So it's not just about caring for our employees. If you care about your business, you should also be caring for your employees.
Mm, mm. Well, I know there are a lot of people in the ballroom downstairs waiting to hear from you, and so I want to let you get to them, but I'm so grateful for you taking a few minutes of your time to share with our national audience, and really look forward to your talk. Thank you so much for being with us, Sean.
Thank you. It's been an honor to be part of this.